This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today we air a forum on the future of nuclear power in Utah with Peter Bradford, professor of law and energy policy at Vermont Law School and a former U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commissioner. While Utah has been a source of uranium throughout the 20th century, it has never embraced nuclear energy production. Now, with a statewide push for decarbonized energy sources and better air quality, Utahns are considering the issue once again. However, placement, scale, cost, and disposal of nuclear waste are still questions that need definite answers. Earlier this year, a non-binding resolution welcoming nuclear power to Utah was passed by the state legislature. The resolution, quote, supports the procurement of energy from advanced nuclear facilities, as well as the construction and operation of advanced nuclear facilities within the state of Utah, and ties the effort to Utah's need to address climate change and clean air. Related to this resolution, and the focus of today's forum, is Utah Associated Municipal Power Systems, or UAMPS, seeking to build NuScale small modular reactors at Idaho National Labs in Idaho Falls. Advocacy group Heal Utah has criticized the project's ability to stick to budget and schedule, and protests the production of new radioactive waste. With the proposal only in its exploratory phase, the 30 affiliated municipalities would not power their cities with nuclear energy until at least 2026. Reviewing the history of nuclear projects in the U.S., Peter Bradford spotlights the risk of small public utilities' involvement in nuclear plant construction, and highlights precautions to protect customers from unanticipated costs.
I do want to spend a little time discussing the relevance of the history of nuclear construction and the risks that it shows for Utah, even though this is a new design being built by folks who were not involved in the past history of nuclear construction. But first, let's make sure we're all on more or less the same page with regard to the project that we're talking about, the so-called carbon-free power project or small modular reactor project that a number of Utah municipal utilities are interested in participating in through the vehicle of the Utah Association of Municipal Power Systems. Specifically, they're considering purchasing 150 megawatts of nuclear power through this umbrella group, call it UAMPS to make use of the acronym. The small modular reactor design would be a first of a kind, that is, typical nuclear power plants that have been considered for construction in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world in the last 20 or 30 years have generally been 1,000 to 1,500 or 1,600 megawatts. The reactors being considered for construction at the Idaho National Laboratory are 60 megawatts, so much smaller. They would be grouped together in a collection of 12. It was a 720-megawatt project altogether, but that's with 12 reactors, whereas one conventional reactor would be larger than that. There's something of an irony to this, which is that throughout the history of nuclear power, from the time the first power reactors came online in the U.S. in the late 50s, until as recently as 2010, the nuclear industry's insistence has always been that the reactors had to get bigger, that they were so expensive to build that they needed to produce the maximum number of kilowatt hours to spread the costs over. And while they were having trouble making the economics of the 1,000 megawatt reactor work, the answer was to go to 1,200 or 1,400 or 1,600. And so they were always pushing on the safety regulators to let them build bigger and bigger designs. But in recent years, even the biggest of those designs has proven to be uneconomic, often on a dramatic scale. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. And so we're seeing now the emergence of a 180-degree turnabout in which the industry now says, actually, we had it wrong all those years. The way to make nuclear power cheaper is to build the plants smaller, build them in through modular construction at the factory site, ship them to the place where they're going to be used, but relatively little on-site construction. And that way, they say, they'll be able to cut the costs. Now, some of the economic characteristics of this project, perhaps the most significant from a customer standpoint, is that in concept, at least, the price is capped at 6.5 cents per kilowatt hour. As we'll see, that's a bit on the high side compared to power markets, but as a cap, it offers some reassurance as to how much risk the participating utilities seem to be taking. There are opportunities for the participant utilities to opt out at various stages, first during the preliminary planning, then during the licensing process, and once more at the commencement of construction. UAMPS is committed to performing what are called economic competitiveness tests, which, if done right, would show the price of this power in comparison to the price of alternative ways of getting the same power, including the same low carbon power. But as we'll see also in a few minutes, there's some question, reason to question whether, as currently structured, the proposal really is going to get at the realities of that situation. And the power is said to be needed by these small municipal utilities, in part to replace retiring coal plants, also to meet the projected fairly rapid load growth in Utah, and to diversify Utah's power supply, which doesn't presently include any nuclear power generation. Okay, now, from my own background in licensing nuclear power plants and regulating the price of electricity, I can tell you that again and again and again, I've seen nuclear projects start out with versions of these same bright hopes, only to end in very expensive disappointments of several sorts. And I'll spend the rest of my talk today outlining what those disappointments have been, how one might go about recognizing them, and also how one might go about guarding against them. In the context of the UAMPS proposal, the risks take at least three forms. One is that the cap will turn out not to be firm after all, and that Utah customers will be exposed to the full run of potential nuclear cost overruns, which is very large indeed. The second, a little more subtle, is that the cap, even if it's firm, is too high. And that risk exists because it hasn't really been tested against the cost of alternative ways of procuring the same amount of power. And that's a very important step in any power procurement process. And the final concern is that the economic competitiveness test, as it's presently structured, is not really designed to test the project in an effective way against all of the possible alternatives. So let's talk a little about the extent of nuclear power's excess cost problem. For the cost estimates for builders of large nuclear reactors today, not just in the US, but in Western Europe as well, are up in the 12 to 20 cent per kilowatt hour range. The Vogtle plant in Georgia, which is the only two plants currently being built in the US, may come in even higher than that. So the level of cost that is built into nuclear power at present is far, far above anything that is characteristic of what you're paying for electricity in Utah now. It's far above anything anyone is paying anywhere else in the US for electricity. And it explains why nuclear power has been unsuccessful in the competitive power procurement processes in many parts of the country. The chart that I'm showing now shows you a couple of things. The blue dots are the cost of all the plants built in the US prior to the year 2000. And as you can see, in the early years of nuclear construction, the costs tended to stay down in the 5 cent a kilowatt hour range, always with a few outlier plants above that. But in the later years, starting around 1980, the costs generally increased pretty dramatically for a combination of reasons. The accident at Three Mile Island certainly caused increases in cost, but there were a number of other factors as well. And so by the end of the last century, nuclear plants were being more regularly completed in the 10 or even 15 cent a kilowatt hour range. Now the pink dots, which start in this century, tell a different story. They're the stories of the cost estimates in the effort that was for some time known as the nuclear renaissance. And an interesting thing about the low numbers, the pink, the furthest on your left of the pink dots, is that they approximate 6 cents a kilowatt hour. They approximate the same level of cost that is the cap being promised for the UAMPS project. But here's the interesting thing about those cost estimates. They were provided by the vendors, by the people who wanted to build the nuclear power plants, and by some academic studies funded by those same vendors. So the potential customers were being told 6 cents is about the right price. But then a few years went by, some legislative support was secured, enthusiasm was stirred up, but eventually the builders had to start disclosing what the plants were really going to cost because they had to get the permission of utility regulators in order to start putting the costs in rates. And you see what happened as soon as that process began to kick in. The cost estimates just went up and up and up. And there's nothing by the end of that time period anywhere near 6 cents a kilowatt hour. And in fact, the most expensive of them are up above 20 cents a kilowatt hour. And in fact, that's consistent with the only one of those plants actually being built, namely the Vogtle plant in Georgia. But a number of others were canceled after a lot of money was spent on them. And that brings me to saying just a few words about the role of public power in this nuclear construction story, because the UAMPS municipalities, of course, are all public power systems. They don't have stockholders to cushion any financial shocks. If things go wrong, they're either going to be protected by that contract or the customers are going to be asked to pay for them. Among the most recent municipal disappointments with nuclear construction, you have Jacksonville, which bought into the Vogtle project in Georgia and is looking at 100% cost overrun in what they expected to pay. They did not have a ceiling. And even sadder, in South Carolina, Santee Cooper, which is South Carolina's equivalent to UAMPS, entered into a nuclear construction project called the Virgil Summer Project. The builder of that project, Westinghouse, went bankrupt. And eventually, after a series of cost overruns were announced, the two utilities building the project decided it just was not economically feasible, and they canceled it. But by the time they canceled it, they'd spent $5 billion on it. $5 billion. A state, I suppose, not so different in size and characteristics from Utah, and they're having extraordinary economic and political impacts spilling out of that. Now, one other item worth noting about these two state experiences, Georgia, South Carolina, both of those plants were of a design called the Westinghouse AP1000. The Westinghouse AP1000 was said to be a design that was going to save a lot of money, going to be a lot cheaper than those blue dots that we saw on that chart I showed a couple of minutes ago. And the reason they were going to save so much money was that they were going to rely on modular construction, just like the M in SMR, small modular reactor. And that was going to enable a great deal of savings because the parts would be prefabricated at factories, shipped to the plant sites, and bolted into the plants with no further work needing to be done at the site. That would make standardization much easier, training much easier, and licensing review easier. Well, unfortunately, as it turned out, none of those hopes were realized. A substantial part of the cost overruns in both Georgia and South Carolina came from the fact that the modular production facility run by the Shaw Construction Group in Louisiana, and later by Chicago Bridge and Iron, wasn't somehow able to get its hands around modular construction effectively and couldn't deliver the modules on time. It had a number of misfortunes, including in one case dropping and ruining an expensive module. So the contribution, in the end, the technique that was hoped to bring about the big cost improvements wound up contributing instead to really epic cost overruns. Well, I'll move quickly over the other projects here. I didn't intend to spend quite that long on that one. But the Washington Public Power Supply System was a consortium of small municipal utilities in the state of Washington, which undertook to build five nuclear plants at once in conjunction with the Bonneville Power Authority, i.e. the Department of Energy. And after a series of large cost overruns, the little municipals decided they just couldn't carry the project any longer. They also felt that they had been misled at various stages by both the builders, the corporate builders, and the Department of Energy. So they stopped making payments on the bonds, which led to the largest, what was then the largest municipal bond default in US history. At the Seabrook Nuclear Plant in New Hampshire, the Massachusetts Municipal Wholesale Electric Company, again, a counterpart to UAMPS, bought into Seabrook and then increased its share of Seabrook just as the costs took off. Seabrook was one of the most expensive of the earlier generation of plants. And MWEC, too, had its bonds substantially downrated. Cajun and Wabash were two good-sized electric cooperatives that bought into nuclear projects, one in the, well, both in the 1980s, but one went bankrupt in the 80s, one went bankrupt in the 90s. So municipal ownership, cooperative ownership has not been any kind of a buffer against both ratepayer impact and substantial misfortune and cost overruns. A few other notes from this earlier history to keep in mind in sizing up assurances that everything's under control and is certain to go smoothly with present-day projects. A surprising fact about nuclear construction, I don't think it's true of any other industry in history, is that more than half of all the plants announced to be built in the United States since the 1950s were canceled. And that total includes many that had gotten their NRC licenses, quite a few that had hundreds of millions spent on them, and a few that had billions. It also includes 29 of the 31 plants that had license applications pending at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission just 10 years ago. That was the peak of what was then thought to be the nuclear renaissance. But in the years since then, as gas prices have fallen and nuclear cost estimates have risen, demand has fallen, energy efficiency and renewables have gotten ever less expensive. One plant after another has been canceled. A number of them were canceled at relatively little cost. They were just paper designs. But a few, like the one I mentioned in South Carolina and another one in Florida, more than $1 billion was spent before the cancellation. One note that I want to make here and then come back to later is that a side effect of these very substantial commitments to building nuclear plants is that it freezes the small utilities power supply planning process for substantial periods of time, especially as the cost overruns kick in, because they're committed to a fairly good-sized block of power from one place. Why would they be looking around at alternatives to it? And the full attention of their management, more and more, is focused on trying to get control of these runaway costs.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety as a public service. Today we are airing a talk given on February 12th. Picking up where we left off, here again is Peter Bradford.
Now let's shift gears into the second of the concerns that I mentioned, namely that the 6.5 cents a kilowatt hour, which is also $65 a megawatt hour, may not be as good a cap as the proponents of this project would like to think. What this slide is showing you is 9 years, 10 years worth of history in the Texas power market, which is a market of a type that doesn't exist in Utah. It does exist in more than half of the U.S., and it enables all types of electric power generation to compete against each other and also to compete against projects that include load management and energy efficiency, so that instead of just taking the projections of a would-be power plant builder, one has an ongoing set of prices to look at in terms of commitments that generators are really prepared to make and stand behind in order to sell electricity. And as you can see, what this graph is telling you is that the average price for every year in the last 10 is under 6.5 cents a kilowatt hour, indeed under 6 cents a kilowatt hour. But more significantly, the average price for the whole period is 3.4 cents a kilowatt hour, or barely half of the proposed capped price in the UAMPS project. So when measured against what power markets in a region not so far from here are providing, the UAMPS price cap, even if, and we'll talk a little more about this too, even if the UAMPS is able to stick with it, is not so great a deal. You're committing to buy power for a very long period of time at a price well above the existing market price. This next chart is just another illustration of the same point, only it comes at it from the standpoint of all of the power markets in the US, not just the state of Texas. And it's only the last 2 years, it's not the last 10. But again, what it's showing you is that in the last 2 years, in every single market in the US, even the ones that are much more expensive than Texas, kilowatt hours never reach the price of 6.5 cents. So there's really no place in the country where a long-term 6.5 cent commitment would look like a good deal today. This next graph is a first cousin to those points. What it illustrates is the recent trends in the price of different types of generation. I apologize, it's probably not so easy to read from where you all are sitting, but in essence, that sharply downsloping yellow line is the price of large solar. The only price that's moving upward is the red line, the nuclear power line. The blue wind line, the other solar line, and the gas line are all moving downward, and they're all below the cost of nuclear energy. The important question that raises for our purposes with regard to the economic competitiveness test that I was talking about earlier is, why in the world is that test only considering gas? Why isn't it considering combinations of these alternatives? Because when nuclear plants have closed, when nuclear power has been displaced, it's almost never been by just one source. It's always displaced by combinations of resources, some in power plants that run more, some in new power plants that get built, some in energy efficiency. Energy efficiency is not even on this chart, but if it were, it would be also well below the nuclear line. Combinations of renewables with storage would be below the nuclear line. Grid management, which is becoming an increasingly important area in power supply planning, would also be below the nuclear line. And the combination of all of them together represents some really large innovative opportunities of the sort, just to look at another utility for a moment, of the sort that we've seen in the telecommunications industry, in which 30 years ago was essentially a set of monopoly propositions based on, well, let's go back 40 years, the old rotary dial phone, and now you've got more intelligence in the smartphone in your pocket than there ever was in the Bell System central offices. That is happening in the electric industry too, more slowly because you can't get away from the wires in electricity the way you can in telecommunications. But the control is migrating out toward the customers more and more as people get control of their appliances, companies get control of their power use. And all of that is antithetical to long-term commitments to large central station sources like nuclear, especially when the price is above the market price anyway. Well, I've kind of anticipated aspects of this slide in that we've seen that the economic competitiveness test focusing only on nuclear power needs to be broadened and perhaps done more often. But there's a second question about the contract and the cap too. And that is really, how firm is the cap? What happens when the project starts to experience cost overruns, which, as we've seen from the nuclear history to date, are almost inevitable, because all you have now are the vendor estimates. And that's never the end of the story. It's always the starting point for an upward sloping line. Well, at some point, as the UAMPS customers sit protected behind their 6.5 cent cost cap, other entities are feeling a lot of pain. NuScale is an owner. If the price doubles or triples, as it has in some cases, can they stand behind that, or might they go bankrupt, as Westinghouse did? Is the Department of Energy committed to picking up the difference between the NuScale, the difference between the UAMPS capped price and whatever the actual cost becomes? Because if the answers to these questions are no, then we know how this story will play out. We saw it in Georgia, we saw it in South Carolina, we've seen it in a lot of other places. One day, the big boys, the builder of the reactor, the Department of Energy, come and knock on UAMPS's door and they say, we're really sorry, we thought we could commit to 6.5 cents a kilowatt hour. It turns out we're just not going to be able to do that. You guys have it in your contracts, but if we don't renegotiate the contract, the project's going to have to be canceled, or the project's going to have to be shut down, or da 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 da. And at that point, the UAMPS members being millions and millions of dollars in the hole, the directors having committed a good deal of prestige to the project, and the argument being, it's not going to cost that much more to complete it. It's not, maybe we wouldn't have gone down this road if we'd foreseen this, but now that we're here and it's only going to cost another $1 billion to finish, it's better to do that than to do anything else. You shouldn't pay attention to the sunk costs. That's what happened in South Carolina and Georgia. Georgia most recently has gone through that process for the fourth or fifth time. And the small municipals wind up agreeing to increase the charges to their customers, because even though they never would have committed to something like this back at the beginning, they genuinely believe it's better to go forward than to drop out. Another possible contingency is some of the owners, some of the UAMPS owners will choose to drop out. Municipals have defaulted in situations like that in the past, leaving the others with the choice of whether to increase their ceiling to pick up the difference. And then finally, there's the problem that occurs with first-of-a-kind plants like this one, where it doesn't operate up to expectations in the early years. I don't know what projections for what's called a capacity factor UAMPS is using in arriving at their cost estimates. What I've seen happen in other situations is that the would-be builder takes the industry average for nuclear plants, which is above 90%, pretty good. But it's not a good number for a first-of-a-kind plant in its early years. There's one plant in its startup phase is now in Tennessee that's capacity factors at 56%. The gas-cooled reactor at Fort St. Vrain in Colorado, built back in the 1980s, never attained a capacity factor above 30%. And when you start seeing numbers like that, it has the effect of doubling and tripling the cost per kilowatt hour, because the capital costs of these plants are so high that if they only produce a third of the kilowatt hours you expected, you have to charge three times more to get them. Fermi 1 was another first-of-a-kind reactor in Michigan. They had a very serious accident not far from Detroit, operated for only a couple of years, and closed down for good after 5 years of operation, again, leaving the long-term fixed costs with the builders. Okay, so what can one do about this? Well, one answer, of course, is don't go there, but let's try to talk also within the framework of the proposal. The first thing that experience in other parts of the countries would suggest is the wisdom of using all source requests for proposals, all source bidding, in which essentially a utility says, we're going to need this much power for this many years. We welcome all proposals and combinations of proposals to see who can provide it for how much money. And by the way, who is prepared to make firm commitments as distinguished from predictions and promises. And that's where you're seeing these really low responses, especially in the solar field in Colorado, in Arizona, Texas, in the last year or so. Furthermore, once you've done that, you then have a real market basis for setting a cap. Instead of setting it at 6.5 cents a kilowatt hour, say to NuScale, Department of Energy, UAMPS, okay, now we know how much power really costs. We'll adjust it in whatever way we think we should for the low carbon qualities, the diversity qualities, the reliability qualities. But that's the cap that we want to see in the contract, not your 6.5 cents a kilowatt hour. And my guess is that the number would be significantly lower. Then, with regard to the cap, if you're going to make it enforceable, you got to know who's going to step up and pay the difference if big cost overruns occur. And you have to be able to enforce that. So if it's supposed to be NuScale, and you ask, well, what happens if NuScale goes bankrupt, because we've seen that movie before, the answer is they have to bond it somehow. They have to make sure adequate revenues are set aside. They may not be able to bond it, but that would be important information to have too, that the bonding companies thought the risks were too large, so why should the ratepayers in small towns in Utah take them? And then finally, just be aware of the full history of nuclear history and the uncertainties that it entails in order to frame your sense of the decision-making risks going forward.
That's Peter Bradford speaking at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on February 12th. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma.
Thank you for that excellent presentation.
Thanks.
Historically, one of the reasons that nuclear has been able to maintain costs relatively low is due to the long time period that nuclear plants can operate. So my first question is, what estimates for costs were being used, and over what time span were they anticipating new power plants to be operating? And my second, which is kind of related, is given that in the European Union we see multiple nations such as France and Sweden implementing nuclear power on a wide scale, with costs significantly less than adjacent neighboring countries which invest heavily in renewables, such as Germany, what do you think is the difference in the cost discrepancy we're seeing between the European Union and the United States?
First of all, as I understand it, the projected The contract life related to UAMPS is 40 years. The existing reactors, most of them have extended their lives to 60 years. The 6.5 cent a kilowatt hour cap, I should have mentioned earlier, is in 2017 dollars. So it's not, it will escalate with inflation over that time. It's not 6.7 cents for those 40 years. It's hard to know whether that's, how good a deal that is. The argument was made in the last round of nuclear power plant construction. Yes, these things cost a lot to build, but once you have them, they operate for a long time at a high capacity factor. And so they provide really substantial economic benefits toward the end of their lives. And I must say, that made sense to me. I believed it when I was regulating back in the 70s and 80s. But what's really happening now is actually the opposite. In the regions with power markets and operating nuclear plants, one after another, these plants are coming in and saying, we can't meet the prices in these markets, especially driven by natural gas, but also renewables and the demand fall off. And the fact that as the plants get older, their operating costs tend to creep up a little. And they're saying, we either are going to close, seven or eight of them have, or we're going to have to get a subsidy from the customers, rate increases, basically, so that you pay us more than the market price to keep us in operation. And New York, Illinois, maybe New Jersey have accepted, as to some of their nuclear plants, for at least a few years, the need to give those subsidies. That seems to stand the argument about long-term benefit on its head. I mean, you paid in the early years so that you would get cheap power in the late years, but now you're having to pay above market power, above market prices in the late years, too. So the history of the last generation, anyway, doesn't really affirm the idea that nuclear units are a long-term economic benefit. A few things are more humbling than trying to forecast power prices. It could be that 40 years from now, gas prices will have turned around. I don't know what could go wrong with the solar and wind and efficiency industries, but maybe for some reason market prices will be back up and the nuclear plants will look good again. But right now, that argument is not so persuasive. As to what's going on in Europe, it's a mixed story. The two plants that have been under construction for a while in Western Europe, Flamanville in France and I never pronounce it right, but Olkiluoto in Finland are both double the number of years it was supposed to take to build them. Again, two advanced reactor designs and billions of dollars over budget. So no one in Western Europe anyway now is building any new plants. The French, I haven't looked at their prices versus Germany's versus Sweden's lately, but I'm not sure it's correct that there's a big difference between German, French, and Swedish prices. And it's confusing anyway, because the Germans export a good deal of power, albeit coal power, to other European countries. Germany does use less nuclear power, certainly, than either France or Sweden. It does use some, although it's committed to phasing it out. And I guess I'm taking a very long way of saying I really don't know the answer to your question, because I'm not sure what the difference between the power prices these days between those countries are. The French nuclear plants are all old plants, or at least 20 years old. They were built under a regime that heavily standardized them. One reactor builder, one design, two different sizes, a national licensor, whereas the US system had four builders, 50 state regulators, and no real effort at standardization. So the French costs have tended to be lower. On the other hand, they have never included some of the costs that we always include in ours, such as waste disposal and decommissioning of the plants. And in fact, I've forgotten the name of their government accounting office, but it's recently kind of blown the whistle on Electricité de France and said, you've got billions of dollars in unfunded liabilities that you're going to have to start charging for before much longer. Sweden, I don't know the Swedish story well enough to comment sensibly at all. Yeah.
Thank you for your presentation. One of the novelties of the new scale design is it's an answer to, in a sense, the Fukushima disaster. It has the capability to shut itself down without power indefinitely and not have a meltdown. And I've looked into their design a lot, and I tend to agree with that. I'm curious, as a previous NRC commissioner, if you have any thoughts on that. And then also a thought, this is a big point in innovation for our country, and I do agree it's irrational to think that a first of a kind will necessarily meet its cost, but then on the other hand, to say that it's destined to fail and try to cut it short before it gets a chance to gain legs is also maybe not the best decision for our country too. So just a comment there, but your thoughts on the safety of the design.
Okay, let me start with the last point, just that it's fresh in my mind, and just to say fair enough that I'm not standing here telling you it's going to fail. I am standing here telling you, though, that I have heard those same hopes, promises, expectations stated in a lot of different forums, and not so many of them have turned out well. So the people in charge of power supply procurement in Utah, who's, after all, it's their decision, I wouldn't advise them to go sailing into it on the basis that the changes that have been made in this design have resolved all of the problems from the past designs, because that really was the premise of the nuclear renaissance 12, 15 years ago. You know, we hadn't built a new reactor in the U.S. in 20, 25 years. Westinghouse, General Electric, Framatome, as it then was, were all knocking on the door saying, we've learned our lesson, we've got it right now. And 29 of those 31 plants are gone, and even the last two are really expensive. So be careful. Don't go cruising in as though this was a slam dunk. There, you know, I'm a lawyer by background, so my safety judgments, taken for what they're worth. I agree with you that there are some attractive safety features about the SMR. If nothing else, obviously, the radioactive inventory is a lot smaller. My one concern there is that there's some tendency on the part of the builders to take credit for the safety in cost reductions. I've just put this hypothetically because I'm not qualified to get much more specific about it, but to say, because there is less heat, lower pressures, less radiation, we can reduce the thickness of the shielding or reduce the offsite emergency planning zones. It seems as though you can get more safety or you can get cheaper costs, and maybe you can get a mixture of each, but you can't fully take credit for both. If you take credit for all the safety improvements by reducing safety margins, then at the end of that day, your safety margin will be the same. You may have a cheaper plant. Sure.
In some of the past debacles, can you describe what the federal government did? And the reason I'm asking is that And I'm a little confused what NuScale is doing and what UAMPS is doing, because I'm a little confused about it. But in Idaho, I'm from Idaho, and in Idaho, they are saying that the federal government will be picking up half the tab of the $4.3 billion. So at some point, and I expect that to happen. So does that just change a lot of your numbers?
It could. I mean, it certainly could for Utah. Remember, I said that one possibility was that if the 6.5 cent cap were exceeded and you had a contract in which the federal government was ironclad tied into absorbing extra costs, then at least you could treat the 6.5 cents or whatever the cap was as being a real hard cap, as distinguished from what I think you have now. The federal history on nuclear energy is a fascinating but also endless subject. It's the only industry that was born entirely in government laboratories, the Manhattan Project. So when you get into arguments about what industry is subsidized, what isn't, nuclear really has had substantial federal sponsorship. The Atomic Energy Commission had all kinds of different grants to encourage the industry startups. And the Department of Energy has played various roles. TVA has played various roles. Bonneville has played various roles as reactor builders, co-owners, supporters. I don't have a problem with a federal role in nuclear energy research. I wish I had some sense that it was the result of a rational prioritization process in which the benefits and costs were compared to other sources. But for example, when the Congress was considering energy legislation that led to some nuclear subsidies 15 years ago, and then on into the Waxman-Markey debates, there were proposals to specifically pay for, I think, 7 demonstration projects in order to see how the different reactor types would work and how they would operate. I didn't feel that was necessarily a bad deal if it included meaningful carbon legislation. My own conjecture was that it would prove that nuclear wasn't economic, but I was perfectly willing to make common cause with those who thought it would show the opposite in order to get a meaningful package done, and then we'd have 7 reactors, and I'm afraid we'd know exactly what we're learning at Vogtle now, but there is a role there for the federal government, but this sort of mindless and under the table subsidizing doesn't strike me as a good one.
So that is all the time we have for today's forum. Please join me in thanking our guests for an interesting and informative forum.
That's Peter Bradford, professor of law and energy policy at Vermont Law School and a former U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commissioner, speaking at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on February 12, 2019. If you missed some of the program or would like to see the visuals referenced in the forum, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. Thanks for listening.